Yeah, it is Tuesday, April 23rd, a little bit after 5 p.m. You know what that means. It's time for Tasty Live's all-new evening show, The Price of Truth, a little podcast where we like to explore the incentives that govern our world. The idea is to have great minds come on and share great ideas. Today is no different, my friends. Today is installment number two of Chris Becchio Tuesdays. Chris, how you doing, my friend?
I'm doing well. This month has not been very friendly for people like myself, but there's a little bit of a rebound here in stocks. Tesla's bouncing. It's a very interesting day. I actually think this is the most important week of the year so far, and perhaps the most important week over the next 3 or 4 months.
Oh, come on, Chris. Listen, you're saying this month hasn't been so good for people like you. Look, if you keep, it's been what, a few percent drawdown in the majors? Come on, my friend.
Vic, I'm a trader. I live and breathe by my daily P&L.
Yeah, that's fair enough. What have you done for me lately? That is the game that we're in, my friend. I guess we got a lot to cover. Audio, video quality for me this week, I'm just going to be honest, everybody out there, not going to be the greatest. I'm traveling. I'm in the midst of travel, so please be patient with me. Do us a favor. Hit the like button. Subscribe to the channel if you're not subscribed already, and just type a bunch of nonsense in the chat. Tell us where you're from. Tell us what you got on. Tell us your convictions for the rest of this week. It's a huge earnings week. We're going to cover a lot of that here in just a second. My good friend, let's get started with Tesla. All hope was lost going into this earnings release, my friend. We closed 144. The narrative was horrific. Everybody said they wanted to see the you know, it's like, I want the old Kanye. You ever see that SNL skit? I want the old Kanye.
Yes.
That's basically what today was. It was like Elon Musk proved to me. It's such a stupid narrative-driven market. Horrific earnings in terms of what they actually put on the board, sales, all that stuff. Not great. But, you know, what does he do? He pulls out the robo-taxi event in August and says, don't look over here, everybody. We got this big robo-taxi event coming in August. It's like, are they really... Is there anything really to talk about substantively different in August? I don't know. I want your opinion on this little rally. We're up to 161 in after hours, 6 or 7% rally. What do you think, man? What do you see? What do you see in the tape action?
The robo-taxi event does not register to me because we've been promised full self-driving vehicles for many years, and you know, I think we're he announced today we're going to get them in 2019, so that's still running ahead of schedule. The event for me is the fact that there's going to be this Model 2 low-cost vehicle, that the Model 3 right now basically is priced at $299 a month with after-tax and after-gas savings. They're advertising it as something closer to $160. What matters to me here is something that we talked about maybe it was a week ago or a few weeks back about Elon Musk's credibility. There was a Reuters report that Tesla was abandoning its goal of having a low-cost mass-produced EV vehicle. Which is basically the whole, when you get into the technological frontier and you're developing a new technology for the masses, it basically goes in three stages. You develop a high-cost, high-end version of the vehicle, which, if it's popular enough, brings in enough revenue so that you can develop a mid-tier, lower-cost version of the same vehicle. And if that's popular enough, you get to the point where you can develop a mass-produced, widely available, low-cost vehicle. And Musk
has
got
the master plan. That's Elon Musk master plan.
Exactly. And so stages one and two are incomplete. And we hear a few weeks back, Reuters puts out a report that stage three is going to be abandoned, that the master plan to deliver an EV to the masses is done and dusted. And Elon Musk says that Reuters is wrong. But the stock suffers anyway. There's a little bit of a rally, but then it dunks down to fresh early lows a few days later. The fact that Tesla comes out today and says, by the way, this plan for a mass-produced, low-cost EV is still on track and we're accelerating the timetable for it, I think is actually very important for credibility in his position as the CEO of the company. So as someone who is sitting on, you know, close to max loss Tesla put spread that I put on a few weeks back, I'm absolutely thrilled that we're seeing a rally here in the stock after hours. Not that this was the plan or what was anticipated. It was just a stock with a high IVR at support, and that's why I did it. But this puts me back in the game, and I may be able to take this off at maybe not a max loss. So I'm thankful here. And I got to say, the thought went through my mind today, like, hey, $299, my wife's just recently started a new job. We only have one car and we got to get a second one. $299 a month, given the availability of Tesla chargers in my area, Doesn't sound too bad.
No, wait, bro. Wait for those Chinese imports.
Oh, no. Hold on a second. I have only ever leased or purchased American Union-made vehicles. And it has to be one of those two things.
But you know
and
what?
Elon Musk is American-made. He's not union, but he's American-made. Yeah. And that's good
in the 1980s, my friend, when those cars were made in the United States, that might have been saying something. But just because you got an American label on a car that was built in Mexico or some other country, it's not really saying much today. You know what I'm saying? I get it. I want to be patriotic. My father, you know, he used to say, you know, we only buy American cars. My mom, too, because she was a union woman. My grandfather on the other side was a Heinz union worker for 30 plus years. It means something. If union workers are getting paid for that labor, but if not, what the hell does it matter what damn labels on the damn car? If the elites can benefit from globalism, why can't the consumer, Christopher?
I agree, and they should, but Chinese cars can come to the American market. I just will never buy one.
I'm joking. I'm not buying one either, but they are sick. I just saw BYD in person for the first time yesterday. You know what? I know I'm
because you're today. Literally in the future right now. I mean, I say that not just figuratively, but you're...
Yeah. I'm in Singapore right now, 13 hours ahead. Half the year it's 13 hours, but the other half it's 14 hours. But I did see one in person. It was pretty slick. It was an SUV. But you know what I think when I hear about the robo-taxi, Chris, because I'm out of my mind insane and something happened over in COVID where my mind just snapped and it broke. Do you know what I hear? When I hear robo-taxi, do you know how many Uber drivers are in the United States? How many people you think
about Ubers? I know enough about the taxi industry because several years ago I had a startup that we got some initial funding for, right? And then the pandemic happened and no one wanted to use taxis anymore. So that went by the wayside. Great
Six
idea.
Million, man. Six yeah, million. No,
the threat to taxi drivers and long haul truck drivers is something that scares one of the things in the back of my head long-term, mm-hmm. right? You think about every conflict over the course of human history. And in fact, we have crime records going back to the 16th century in the Western world, the United States, Germany, France, United Kingdom, and then a little bit more forward in time, then you can include Italy and Spain into that grouping as well. And 95% of violent crime is committed by men between the ages of 15 and 35. And so when you have millions, tens of millions of men, working age men that are without a job because they didn't learn how to code, as some politicians flippantly suggest. It seems like it's a recipe for societal issues. So robo-taxis, robo-long-haul trucks, it does not mean a utopian state where people can work on discovering their inner selves and, you know, practicing the arts, which is, you know, that sounds nice, trust me, but that's not what it means in the immediate future, no.
You know, and that's what everyone will say. Look, it frees up all these Uber drivers to go work on their creative pursuits. It's like, bro, they're doing that as a gig job on top of whatever their full-time job is to bring in money. Those 6 million people
get a different gig.
Yeah, they're not going to go sit in front of an easel somewhere and become the next one. Like, what are you guys talking about? Is there anyone out there with any empathy or planning for what this eventually means for our society? But I guess I'm just barking at the moon, my friend. The point is, for now, Tesla rallies to 160. I don't know if you've had time to think about this. You're long for now. I was, as I said before, I've been eating this. I'm wearing some Tesla here. I bought some in the after hours. You know, I've got this ratio spread on 145 to 140. If I was a good trader, I would have took that off right before earnings. I did not. As a little bit of a hedge, but that's the way it is. Rallies tomorrow. Do you do anything with this? Do you add to the position? Do you fade this position? Do you think, does this in any way change the narrative for you now that we're up, you know, $16 from our closing price?
Philosophically, I never add to losers, and it's still a losing position even with the rally today. I'm just hoping I can get out of this at less of a loss. I think that Tesla is still highly overvalued. I think if you look at it compared to traditional OEMs, other EVs, if you want to take out the software component, you know, there's a very promising aspect to the company. The battery storage business is growing very rapidly right now, like 50% year over year. And battery tech is necessary to get us to the next stage of energy storage and development. And obviously, like battery store energy, great observation, Chris, but we don't have the capacity right now to, you know, if you think that you want to live in a green future, you may think climate change is BS or whatever. Getting to a place where we don't have to spend, you know, it's about productivity at the end of the day. If we can generate more energy for less cost with less pollution, why wouldn't you do that? So to get there, though, you're going to need better battery storage. And that's, Tesla has a very promising battery storage business. Can that become the prime narrative and motivating factor? Maybe. Right now, it's obviously not. There's a lot of other concerns swirling around it. So for me, this is just about hoping to get out of a hole and, you know, be able to take home a few more poker chips. Outside of that, look at the charts. They're ugly as heck. But going into today's report, the highest short level of short interest in the stock in 3 years. And so the fact that there is a silver lining that maybe they actually are bringing forward something to the consumers, and the Reuters report was wrong, and that Elon Musk, his credibility isn't totally shot, can't hurt. Doesn't hurt any more than what's been hurting.
What do you think the biggest possible catalyst to Tesla's share price is in the next 3 months? I've got mine. I'm just curious what yours is. I'm happy to share mine first if you want.
I would think oil. That's first and foremost.
Jeff Curry, who was, go ahead.
No, Jeff Curry's a great, I'm curious about this insight, at Goldman Sachs, right?
He used to be at Goldman. He left. He's now he's now over at Carlyle.
Okay.
Well. I think he was on Bloomberg or something like that today. And he said that the, you know, he's always a commodities bull. Not always. In fairness, he's called some down cycles too. But he said that the probabilities of $100 oil are extremely high. Now, he didn't quantify that in any way. Let's say your right tail for oil normally is 5%. And in his mind, it's 15%. Well, that doesn't necessarily mean there's a greater than 50% probability of us getting there. So I don't really know how he quantifies that. And the interviewer didn't ask. But I that's the immediate thought that I had, is in a potential scenario, we do have a lot of geopolitical conflict. We start squawking about $100 oil, to me, in the near term, because what other catalysts are you going to have for Tesla other than it cheap with short covering? You know, that's a potential catalyst in the short term. But other than that, once you get past the sugar high and people start going, oh, people still aren't buying cars, Tesla's still laying people off, China's still got a $15,000 competitor, and rates aren't going down anytime soon, making financing not necessarily easier, consumers aren't in a better position, and future policy is not any more clear. To me, I go, the thing that once you get past the sugar high, you're still going, okay, what's the next earnings and what the hell is this robotaxi thing going to be about? And I don't know, in the absence of $100 oil, you have something sustainable here. Maybe you trade sideways at best, but who knows? I'm not talking my book because I'm net long deltas here, but I'm curious to transition from Tesla into oil, how you're thinking about crude oil, and we can kind of go back and forth if you want between Tesla and oil here.
I mean, Tesla needs a catalyst. I'm actually on Tesla.com right now, just like, what are the prices right now for me in the area? After all the credits and everything, I can get a Tesla Model Y for $29,000 here in New York. I mean, that's getting pretty cheap, right? What can help them? I mean, they're losing pricing power. That's always the downfall of these companies that are at the leading frontier of a new industry. Competitors come into the space and they figure out how to make the same wheel, or dare I say a better wheel, not saying that BYD is better than Tesla, but if it's close enough and the price is that much more substantially cheaper, then you're going to see substitution effect, plain and simple, for consumers across the globe. Because at the end of the day, the idea of the car being a central part of people's personality is a very American concept. For the global consumer, people just want to get from point A to point B. You don't really see that same type of car culture. I mean, in a few Middle Eastern countries, perhaps, and among the ultra wealthy. But for the average person, you could say that the average person, there's a reason why the whole like middle-aged crisis trope of buying a, you know, dyeing your hair jet black and buying a red convertible is a thing for, you know, certain segments of the population. But that's not like a stereotype in Europe or like in the Middle East. So I think people globally are pretty agnostic about their vehicle choice. And if they can get a BYD vehicle for 15K or a Tesla for 30, and it has the same mileage, and you know, you're in Singapore or you're in South Africa or you're in Dubai, I mean, what do you care? What's the, I mean, are you doing it for the, maybe it's for the luxury, like there's like a Vespin good aspect here where people are paying for the brand. But outside of that, it's tough sledding. It's hard to justify the bull case right now. You have to see some material improvement moving forward. But being a bull really means being an investor. Being a trader means finding an opportunity when volatility is high and the market looks like it's overstretched, which we are coming off of an overstretched level, record high over the past 3 years in terms of short positioning in the market, short interest in the market.
You know, obviously it was a positive day in equities all across the board, but it looks like in after hours, you're seeing a little bit of that Tesla halo effect. Rivian closed at 904. It's now trading 923 by 926. Li Auto, Chinese competitor, closed at 2480, now trading 2523. So it seems, you know, a little bit of that maybe short pressure, or let's call it pessimism, regardless, starting to come out, not just of Tesla, but it seems the EVs more broadly, which these things have been absolutely, you know, decimated, especially Rivian, Li Auto, XPeng, none of this stuff. All these charts look horrific, regardless of where their home country is. And it looks like at least a little bit of life is being breathed in, into the entire space here. All right.
I just want to make one point about this. Like one of the, I'm just looking up the exact number right now, so I make sure I have it. But, you know, we heard through the Infrastructure Act that the Biden administration did, we have just short of $1 billion. I think it's actually close to $600 million allocated to electric vehicle charging stations across the country. And right as of the end of last year, zero had been installed. Only four states right now, as of the end of March, have federally funded EV chargers. So this is also one of the friction points that we're facing for this kind of adoption that Tesla's facing as this kind of adoption. If you're the marginal consumer and you're in a middle income or lower income area, it's an EV charging desert right now. And it may be more difficult and burdensome to your schedule as a middle class or lower income person to have to go out of your way to get to fill up your tank, so to speak, to fill up your battery. And so the lack of available charging stations may be one of those factors that's hurting a lot of these EVs right now in the United States. And you've seen with Toyota and Ford and Stellantis, they've all shifted back. Well, let's go hybrid first. We're actually not quite ready to go full EV yet. We need to go hybrid first because the infrastructure is just not there. That's a big problem, I think. When that gets solved and we see those chargers popping up, you could start to feel a little bit more constructive about more adoption. But right now it feels like it's saturation's here. Unless, of course, I can get this for 29K and, you know, we need another car soon. So a Ford Explorer for 35K or a Tesla Model Y for 29.
You know what? Before we move on to sort of the broader markets, I've never asked you this question, nor I actually have never had this conversation with anybody on air. So I'm curious. You know, you're a really sharp thinker. Hope you don't mind me throwing something that's way out of the scope of what we're sort of talking about.
Yeah.
Electrification. We've never talked about electrification as a theme, not necessarily as a theme brought about by the consumer, but as something that's clearly sort of a top-down initiative by the government. Whatever those reasons seem to be, whether it's sort of like energy redundancy away from adversaries, regardless if it's sort of this climate change initiative. You know, states like California, even the federal government, the whole idea of putting billions of dollars towards not just the chargers, but towards these tax credits for buying an electric vehicle, towards subsidizing the vehicle makers themselves. What do you think about the electrification theme brought about by sort of the push by the government in the United States? Do you have a thought? Have you spent some time thinking about that?
I think it's definitely one of the contributing factors for what's happening in copper prices in recent months, where we started to see those break out. Sure. You know, everyone pays attention to oil and gold as your geopolitical safe havens. No one really looks to copper for that. It's much more growth sensitive and it's been on a tremendous run, even with recent setbacks factored in. Copper is instrumental for electrification of the grid and really of any growing economy, which is why people call Dr. Copper, because it gives you the diagnosis where the global economy is ultimately heading. But this is one of the problems right now that we're facing in the United States, not just for EVs, but also for AI. Mark Zuckerberg was talking about this last week. There's a clip that's circulating on FinTwit about him discussing how AGI probably doesn't make a leap forward over the next year or two, maybe through the end of 2025, simply because we don't have the energy resources available to build the kind of data centers and power consistently those data centers to make the leaps forward in AGI that are necessary. And so I think over time, you're going to see, and we've been on this shtick for years between you and me, when it was Jones and friends, now it's the Price of Truth. Like, we need nuclear. We need those stepping stones. And you're starting to see a lot more people come around to that finally. So electrification will only move forward. Demand for copper continues to increase. Available supply, not really going much of anywhere. I know that you have some business in companies and commodities related to like FCX, for example. You're very much a bull in that regard. The last time that we spoke, at least you were. And I think that's very reasonable, looking how things need to shape moving forward. I mean, if it's China, if it's the United States, if it's the Eurozone, to electrify, you need, it's a necessary step, quite frankly. It's absolutely necessary. And without it, we're going to hold ourselves back productivity-wise, economically speaking. Which in 2024, we're talking about like electricity is important for the economy. Right? Like, you think people would have figured that out by now? That, but I don't know. What do I know?
I guess where I was going with that, and it was a great answer. It's just like there's a clear push by government towards these industries, and I wonder when. Does it make sense? Are we in a capitalist country and a capitalist society or not? Do we believe in price as the mechanism that determines supply and demand, or that helps to determine supply and demand, or supply and demand finding that price equilibrium or not? And it just seems like, this gigantic push for, limiting carbon emissions, or just not being able to sell an ICE vehicle at all by certain dates. To me, the thought was brought about by your earlier statement, which is buy American vehicle. That's the patriotic thing to do. Well, America is also a constitutional republic. We're a democracy. We're a capitalist country. And it seems like there are some. That's where I'm going. I'm beating around the
bush. Well, I'm not saying that we're becoming socialist. I'm saying, are we actually a capitalist economy, or are we like a mixed market economy? I think that we're a mixed market economy.
We are 100%. And does it make sense? Does it make sense to be pushing us towards this world of carbon credits limitation, or maybe I'm only using this as an example.
Like, carbon credits are BS. So like. As a liberal, it's like high time that we recognize that they're nonsense.
They're
nonsense.
Some places in the country are flirting with the idea. People are worried about losing their gas stove, which I know is like, whatever. But at that same time, now we're talking about needing massive, massive amounts of energy to power electrification and increase electrification, grid to support electric vehicles. And we're also talking, Chris, as you just alluded to, we're talking about supporting AI. We're talking about needing superhuman computing and the energy to support all of this stuff. And it's like, does anyone understand the cognitive dissonance that we have while at one level saying we need to limit the individual's consumption, while at the same time saying we need to completely expand our energy capabilities on the other side? It just, to me, it doesn't make any sense. Let the consumer choose which vehicle they want, or which method of energy they can afford.
Well, I mean,
it doesn't seem like we're doing that right now.
Do we trust government to do this right? I mean, in theory, there's a good outcome here, and you need stepping stones.
No.
But in practice, I think about my great state of New York, for example. We want to get to a greener, more energy efficient future where we pollute less. And so what did we do a few years ago? We shut down Indian Point Nuclear Power Plant right up the Hudson from New York City. And what's happened since then? The state's emissions related to power output have risen because we've had to rely more on gas and coal as opposed to carbon-free nuclear.
Beautiful, clean coal.
So we got rid of that dirty, dirty nuclear, and we replaced it with clean gas and coal, and even clean natural gas, right? There's a relatively cleaner than what we used to do in the past, but it's still going to produce carbon emissions. So, robbing Peter to pay Paul. Like, yeah, we got rid of the nuclear for the environmentalists, just like Putin did in Germany. And now, like, oh, there's a war that's affecting energy supply. What a coincidence. I don't know. I think the green movement's been totally hijacked and corrupted here in the United States. And it's, you know, I'm full throttle, full for nuclear. As you know, I've been for years. We need it. It's necessary. And the reason why we can't get to a place where we want to be with electric vehicles simply is because of infrastructure, lack of available power, lack of charging stations. But more importantly, Vic, like, should that be something the government's involved in? Of the areas of your life that you want the government involved, people can go back and look this up themselves. The concept of fiscal multipliers. For every government that's taxed, for every dollar that the government is taxed, I'll rephrase that. For every dollar that the government taxes, how much economic output do we get out of it? And some things are like, for every dollar the government takes in, no, for infrastructure, it's like $5 for every dollar. It's good. It's very positive. Like, education and infrastructure are two of the things that have positive long-run fiscal multipliers. There's a lot of stuff out there where it's like, we get back 5 cents for every dollar we spend. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's for the social safety net, and therefore it's not supposed to make money. Like public libraries, do we make money on public libraries or you know, public transportation? No, because they're public. It's not intended to make money. It's not a capitalist enterprise. It's a service for the community. But there are other things like infrastructure has very significant positive fiscal multiplier. So you want the government making those kind of investments because that supports private industry. I don't mean to echo the whole Obama, you know, oh, did you build a business here? You didn't do that by yourself. But in reality, like there's a kernel of truth in that. It was a very ham-fisted way of describing the whole thing of without the collective pooling of resources to sustain bridges and tunnels, then the businesses that have flourished by using those bridges and tunnels to transport their goods and services wouldn't have been able to do such, and therefore they wouldn't have made that money. So having the skeleton of the economy sustained in the collective pool is good so that individuals can flourish on top of that infrastructure. But we're not doing it successfully. That's the problem. Like, we have $623 million allocated for EV chargers, and coming into this year, none were installed yet, and that's years down the pipeline. And so how do you get the adoption you want if that's the goal? EV, though, is due for a correction simply because where are these government subsidies? Do you think that Trump's going to continue them? I mean, you have to plan in the future.
Depends on who donates to his campaign. depends on who gets them out of legal trouble.
I don't see that as an immaterial factor as well. Like, why is he taking the turn from being like this climate changing visionary, like, let's fight climate change and save humanity. You know, we're all in this together, to someone who's posting memes from particular angles on the internet. There's a non-zero part of me that thinks like he's just trying to position himself so he can negotiate with the Trump administration to keep his vehicle credits.
Let me ask you this, because you mentioned nuclear energy. I'm long CCJ. We're going to get to the overall market performance today, as well as bonds, gold, crude oil. We just talked about a little bit. We didn't talk about the actual price action for today. But I'm long CCJ. I'm long URA, a couple of different uranium areas, which I kind of think will be soft. I'm long, as you mentioned, FCX as well. I closed out a lot of my copper, if not all of my upside copper calls. I think it's probably extended in the short run. But I think, like, don't you think nuclear is kind of this the ultimate NIMBY? It will be the ultimate NIMBY, like, topic. Everyone, you know, I won't say everyone. A lot of people are going to want a cheap energy source, but when it comes to, okay, you want this in your state?
I mean, it really is. Yeah, I mean, like, this is the whole, you look at polls of American citizens, the same thing goes for housing, right? Like, should we build more housing? Yes. Would you be interested in upzoning your neighborhood so that we can build denser housing, put an apartment building on your block? And the answer is always no. Right. So, like, it's someone else's problem. Is a solution needed? Yes. Will I be part of it? Absolutely not. And that is a nuclear issue, obviously, because there's a lot of propaganda out there about how unsafe it is. And if a nuclear reactor goes through a meltdown, you know, people think of Chernobyl or Fukushima. But reactors, the way that they're designed today, are much, much safer. They're much more efficient. And quite frankly, if this is the thing I have trouble squaring, I think climate change is a legitimate issue. I think it's a potential global changing issue. I think it's an issue that may fundamentally impact the way that my daughter carries herself in her life. And so if it's that scale of an issue, shouldn't I be willing to do whatever it takes to solve it, to protect my family, to protect my home? And should I be willing to risk the infinitesimal small likelihood of a nuclear meltdown for the greater service of saving the planet. That seems like a good risk to reward. So then I see environmentalists opposing and I go, huh? Where are you coming from? Who's signing your checks? So yeah, we need more nuclear. No one's going to want it, but it's necessary. And, you know, where do you put it? You can't put it in the middle of New York City, obviously, but you got to put it close by. Maybe there's a town 25, 30 miles up the Hudson River. Oh, wait, we did that already and we shut it down. Well, I guess we're screwed, Vic.
All right, man, let's talk about overall market action today. Obviously, it was a very positive, constructive day for markets. What was your read on just the majors? When you talk about the S&P, the NASDAQ, the Russell, and the Dow, what was your read on the strength that we had today?
It's difficult to tell if this is the low or a low for the market. One condition that we were coming off of at the end of last week was that fewer than 8% of stocks in the S&P 500 were trading above their one-month moving average. An occurrence with the people to look back on their charts has typically occurred around lows in the market. Now, whether or not those are lows for a few days or a few weeks or ultimately a major swing low, like we've seen over the past 3 years, is a different story. But it usually does mark some sort of low. And we've had the corresponding bounce, where now there's about 29% of stocks above their one-month moving average in the S&P 500. And we've seen about 100-point rally. I'm more concerned with the fact that this feels like a bull trap, if you will, because we haven't necessarily cleared the important technical thresholds to get us back into a place where you could say, okay, the momentum has turned higher right now. The earnings this week are so important for me. I mean, I'm really, as someone who's constructive on markets still longer term, when I say longer term, I mean outside of the 45 DTE expiration window. The way that the markets responded thus far this quarter has been really disappointing. Over the past 5 years, according to FactSet, over the past 5 years, the average return for a stock that's seen a positive earnings beat has been 1% over the 2 days before, 2 days after the earnings announcement. Historically speaking, when stocks have had a negative EPS surprise, they've lost 2.3% in that 4-day window. This quarter so far, stocks with positive EPS surprises, 0% average return during those 4 days. Stocks with negative EPS surprises, well, before Tesla, negative 6.1%. So winners are not being rewarded and losers are being punished in this market. And we have three of the big companies coming up around the corner. I don't include Tesla in that. I'm thinking more about Meta, Alphabet, Microsoft. Which those three, plus your NVIDIA, plus your Amazon, those five companies are expected to produce 64.3% year-over-year earnings growth. The rest of the S&P 500, the other 495 stocks, are expected to produce negative 6% earnings growth for this year. So in an environment where all of the earnings growth rests on the shoulders of five stocks, and the market is punishing stocks that don't meet expectations, without Amazon, Microsoft, NVIDIA, Alphabet, right? Like, is that these companies not just meeting, but blowing out? This is a market that right now is very much in a sell strength, sell weakness kind of mode. It's not good news is bad. It's very much good news is okay news and bad news is terrible news. It's not like where we were earlier this year, where it's like bad news is good news and good news is great news. So if we can weather this week, that's really what I'm thinking about as a bull. I want to weather this week. And if we can get through, I say this week, not through this Friday, but through next Wednesday when the Federal Reserve meets. If we can get through next Wednesday without producing new lows relative to where we were on Thursday evening last week in the S&P and the NASDAQ, that means ES holds above like 49.64 in the ESM4. If we can hold above last week's lows, I would feel much more constructive moving forward. But this week is the tough week. The next few days are really where push comes to shove. I think this is going to be the defining week for the next 3 or 4 months. Because if its earnings don't meet the metal, you can say, well, earnings growth isn't there and the PMIs are getting bad and price pressures are rising and the Fed isn't going to cut in the first half of this year. And you know what? I've had such a good run from the October lows. I think it's a good time for me to step back. I think you can then have that conversation. And then the other side of it is, hey, you know what? Earnings are better than anticipated. And who cares if the Fed's raising rates? The economy is still strong. GDP is out on Thursday. And we don't need the Fed to cut rates because the Fed cuts rates when things are bad. And so they're not cutting rates because things are still too good. Okay, well, the reinflation trade's back on. So it's like we're kind of at that precipice right now where if you're a bull or a bear, if you've been long off the lows last week, you're feeling okay still. if you're short, you may have a chance to reload at a higher level. And that's where it matters to me. So 51, we'll call it 5170 in the S&P. Get us through 5170, get us through 18K in the NASDAQ. Bulls feel a lot better. Until we're through that area, you have to be very cynical and distrusting of the rally as far as I'm concerned. And I say that as someone who picked up a small long position on Friday night while I was watching Iranian state TV to see if they were going to respond to Israel, it being the Ayatollah's birthday. And so I got in at 49.97 in ES, and it's been a nice little run. But like, I'm not long in size. I'm not comfortable. I'm very much concerned that I've, you know, it's like a death rattle right now. The market's bouncing. It's the dead cat bounce, perhaps. So I'm not feeling really confident, as it were.
Do you see, so if I just look at the VIX, we spiked on the 19th last week to like 21, right? And ever since then, we've gotten three straight sessions of just pounding that excess premium that was built into the market. And you could make that case for a lot of different areas in the marketplace. You can make that case for crude oil in a certain sense. The geopolitical premium that was built in there started to come out a little bit. You can make that case for maybe not so much crude oil, but you can certainly make it for gold. And then you've seen a little bit of a tailwind in equities. Do you see, you know, this rally here that we've seen over the last couple of sessions, do you see it as more, hey, we got past the Iran, Israel kind of back and forth, whether it was scripted or whatever the case may be, we're sort of past, you know, the depths of that potential conflict or the potentials there, and you're now starting to see some of that geopolitical premium priced out? Or do you see this as something more than that, that we got to those technicals, those 100 period moving average in a lot of these major equities, and you say, look, if they can't break them here, there's a decent enough risk reward to go long? Or is it sort of this confluence? I sort of see these things as a confluence of You're at a technical, you don't have the momentum to break it. The geopolitical concern is now being taken off the table. There's a massive, just on a short-term risk-reward pot odd scenario, there's a decent opportunity here. But once you maybe gobble up all of that that risk-reward that's there on the table, you move off those technicals, you're still left with a marketplace that probably is not going to be as strong as people think, a big question mark around inflation, and still those geopolitical concerns remain. You just got out of, you know, the short-term spat. You know, do you see this little rally as just a confluence of factors, of reasons to basically take some risk and also cover your shorts over the last three sessions?
I see this as a place where if I'm short, I probably would have already taken profit on Friday. Same. Because, you know, the measured move off the high in the S&P 500 was 5,000.25, 5333.50 minus 5167.25. Wrote about this a few weeks ago. You and I talked about the levels last week, basically watching like, are we going to get above 5125 or drop below 5078? And if you get 5078, it's a straight shot to 5,000. You know, check the tape. That was last Tuesday. And so we got there. We hit the target. And so if you're trading it as a head and shoulders pattern, the move exhausted itself as of Friday, as of Thursday evening when Israel was attacking Iran back. Same thing for the NASDAQ, because the NASDAQ's measured move off the high, roughly speaking, 18,700 to 18K. The actual target was 17,306. And we got there. Again, we overshot. Technical analysis is more of an art than a science. And when you have a geopolitical thing or an earnings release, you may overshoot, you know, a level or target by a few, you know, points because of the liquidity conditions. So that being addressed, both of those had already hit their targets to the downside. So if I'm a bear right now, I want to see what happens when we get back to our 1 month moving averages, which we're quickly racing towards. Because where's the 1 month moving average right now in S&P? Well, it's at like 51, 52. And so then you can envision in your head, okay, if the neckline of the head and shoulders pattern was 5167 and change, and this 1 month moving average, which we wrote up all the way from the November low up until the first week of April as support, if that's now in that area as well, that should be the area where we should not rally through, right? We should retest the neckline. And if I'm a bear, I want to see it fail there. We should retest the 1 month moving average and we should see it fail there. And if it doesn't fail there, this was the correction. What we just saw last week was the low. And that's not that far away right now. The risk to reward getting in short right now isn't fantastic. The risk to reward getting long also isn't fantastic, because where are you going to set your stop? 49.60 and hope that we can breach 51.50, 51.70? So this is, to me, is like a dead zone for traders trying to get into the market right now. You either were long at the end of last week, or you were short and you took profits and you're looking forward to re-entry. And that's why, between the earnings with Microsoft and Alphabet and Meta, and now with the Fed next Wednesday, most important week of the year. The technicals are there. The catalysts are there. Let's get through it. You mentioned the geopolitical event risk, though. Yeah, that has absolutely come off the table. Oil vol is down substantially, lower than where it was on April 3rd, when Zahedi, the Iranian general, was killed in Damascus from that Israeli airstrike. So oil vol is now lower, both in IVR terms and in raw implied volatility terms, than where it was on April 3rd. I think we can say that that risk is off the table completely. And so you're not really trading these markets based on that. It's very noteworthy today that oil prices and stock prices both went up together. That's very much a first quarter of 2024 type of occurrence. That's not something that we've seen since April 1st. So perhaps welcome news for equity market bulls that oil is no longer scaring the living daylights out of the bulls.
What do you think about the yield curve here, man? Whether it be the front end of the curve, the back end of the curve, meaning, or the 210, or even like the 13-month 2-year, which I think is still inverted by like 40 basis points, something like that. It seems to me that the long end of the curve still seems like it's trading heavy, but for all intents and purposes, for the last couple of sessions, things are sitting in a pretty tight range in the back end of that curve. What's your thought on the yield curve here and just rates in general?
What's the scene? What is it? Mad Men, Don Draper's in the elevator, and that young employee says to him, I feel bad for you. And Don Draper, you know, John Hamm, looks at him and goes, I don't think about you at all. Sorry, yield curve. I really haven't thought much about you right now. You know, seeing the inversion stick around makes a good deal of sense, because we're bending a little bit of a reacceleration.
It's flat, though. Yeah, are we inverted by 30 basis points or something? It's like,
but it hasn't done anything.
What does that mean? Yeah.
So, like, what's the trade?
Two or three cuts, we're flat again. Okay, what does that mean? Does two cuts save the economy at this point? Like, I'm with you there. But for all intents and purposes, I don't think we should be caring about the 40 pip inversion. We have a flat yield curve right now.
Yield curve hasn't done anything in months.
What does that mean for the economy?
Doesn't mean anything. This is one of the difficulties.
2 weeks ago, we had a disgusting bear steepener.
We did, and we've had bear steepeners in the past where the markets also, where stocks have been up. Like, you can point to different times when bear steepeners mean stocks rally or stocks fall. I think one of the important things we're able to recognize, there is an inherent limitation in yield curve analysis, which is to say that the statistical body of information that we have about yield curve inversions is not substantial enough to draw any significant conclusions, where you could say, like, the sun's going to rise tomorrow. I feel pretty good about making that bet that the sun's going to rise tomorrow. You know, we're talking about what, 7 occasions, if you're looking at the 210 spread inversion since World War II. We look at statistically significant sample sizes as at least 30 instances. So by the time we get to 30 instances in a yield curve inversion, you and I will be dead. Our kids will be dead. Our grandkids will be dead. Our great grandkids will be dead.
When you say yield curve inversions, which yield curve are you referring to?
210. I'm
guessing not the two. Okay. Well, or, the two's only been around since like the 70s,
but,
right?
Yeah, but that's the point. But that's the point. We don't have enough history with these to say that this is at, because if we go the next 23 occurrences where a yield curve inversion doesn't precede a recession, then there's your 30 samples, and all of a sudden, 23 out of 30 times, it doesn't matter. Not to say that that's where we're going, but it's difficult to ascertain that this really does matter. Maybe there are implications to the bond market, but in terms of what it means to the economy right now, look, the behavior makes sense. The market begins to anticipate the start of a Fed cutting cycle. So short-term rates plunge. Usually you get something of a bull flattener when you're getting into a recession territory. We're not seeing that behavior right now because the economy's hot and the federal government's spending so much damn money, right? 6-7% current account deficits annually. We just passed another big spending bill. So how are we going to get bad economic growth? Why should the yield curve do anything here? I thought we may get a little bit of acceleration coming out of the March FOMC meeting when Powell talked about shifting the composition of assets in the Fed's portfolio, and maybe that would lead to a little bit of steepening, and it really hasn't. Just, I have no interest here right now. I really would like to, because the going into inversion territory a few years back was one of my better trades of the year. I didn't miss the, I missed the move from 100 basis points negative to up where we are right now. So I'm not going to chase, but you said, like, it's yourself. It's flat. It's dead. This is going nowhere. Nothing of interest. No big claims. No big predictions. No money on the table.
Okay. Well, then no money. There's no money behind this next question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. If you had to pick one, would you rather go long the short end in the twos, or would you rather go short the long end in the tens? And the reasoning of this question is basically, do you think we're in restrictive territory and therefore headed towards material economic weakness, which would mean you would go long the twos? Or do you think we are nowhere near or not in restrictive territory, the economy is strong, and the government, no matter who wins, is locked into this position of needing to continue the spending spree? It's just maybe where you deploy that throughout the economy may change, but you probably need, you can't, the idea of getting elected and going towards austerity at this point in time is probably very unlikely. So in that scenario, would you rather be short the long end? So basically you can only pick one, you can't do both, or some, you know, clever trade. You going long the twos, or you going short the tens? And I want the chat, same question to you. If you can only pick one, you long the twos or you short the tens, tell me in the chat below. What do you think? If you can only pick one.
I think time frame matters here, but I would say that if I could hold them to, let's just say that the trade was over the next 2 years, would I rather be trying to get long the twos or try to short the tens over the next 2 years through the duration of the 2 year? I'd actually be rather long the twos, because mathematically it's very difficult to lose money if you hold a 2 year note to expiry, right? At this point in time, you'd have to see yields shoot up to about 6.25%, I believe. I have to double check my math on that. I'm doing it off the top of my head, which isn't very good. But I will say that you have to see a serious deterioration in ZT to get a loss in terms of being long the contract. So if you said like 2 years, you can only do one or the other. You either can be long the twos and continue to stay long the twos, and every time you initiate the trade 45 days in, at 21 days, you have to roll up to be long again, either through a call spread or just outright a long ZT future, I would much rather be long the twos than short the tens. Yeah.
Right on. I think
the Fed needs to hike. I don't think they have the balls to hike.
Question. You answered it though.
I think the Fed needs to hike. I don't think they have the guts to hike. I think then the twos have a lot more upside, because if you get a sell off in the tens that signals higher inflation, the economy does come to a stopping point at some point, and then the Fed does cut. And if you're one of those people who also believes in fiscal dominance, then you're predisposed to thinking the Fed has to cut rates anyhow, because we can't afford this debt burden. And so what would you do? You want to think that we're closer to a peak in rates or closer to a bottom in rates if you're a fiscal dominance believer? So long the twos for me.
Oh boy, scary environment we're in, but who cares? Just keep buying, number goes up. Speaking of number goes up, Bitcoin with a nice little, dare I say, miraculous turnaround from the 60,000 or a little bit below 60,000 we were at maybe a week and a half ago, up to 66. You doing anything with this as a trader? I know you're maybe long-term holder. Does this 66 level, is it interesting to you at all?
I don't trade it. There's no reason to trade it. But the other thing is, I think one of the important takeaways from Bitcoin is everyone says it's a safe haven and it's a value of storage. Why weren't people or murdered. Store value? Why murdered. Was Bitcoin behaving the way that it was last week? I will hold that again, as I have for years in our conversations, Mr. Jones. Bitcoin is a extremely long duration asset that is at the furthest end of the risk spectrum, because investing and trading, you're making a choice along a continuum of choices. Should I put my money in cash? Right. And I think that's the question here for everything. Would you rather be long cash or long gold the next 3 months? Would you rather? Because there was a point last week where if you were long cash from the start of the year, there was a point on Thursday evening where you were outperforming the NASDAQ year to date. So would you rather be long cash or the NASDAQ the next 3 months? Would I rather be long Bitcoin or cash the next 3 months? I think there's a very reasonable case to be made that cash and Bitcoin could trade hand in hand, where you just get a lot of chop here in this market. It is a sideways distribution here since we had the ETFs come into play. You look at the market since the end of February, it's been between 60K and 74K, more or less. Until that changes, as a trader sitting directly in the middle of that range at 66,357, what do you do? Are you going to go into the futures market and sell a strangle or an iron condor? That would actually be reasonable. But taking a directional bet in the middle of a 2 month long range, patience, right? You're supposed to be ticker agnostic. Wait for your setups and the market conditions to come to you, and then mechanically operate when they meet the conditions for the trades and that particular strategy. There is no strategy here that makes any deal of sense for me. Where we are in the short term, where we are in the long term. If you're a long-term person, hold. If you're a short-term person, flip a coin. You will get the same. That will give you the same amount of edge that I feel like I have looking at this market right now and the charts over the past 2 months.
What's the halving mean to you? Does it mean anything?
Nothing.
To you personally?
No, it doesn't. Everyone's saying this is the end of the run. I would challenge people, and I don't have them off the top of the head, although I've read this recently. I don't know if it was. There are two Twitter followers who I can't remember. It's killing me. Either nope, it's Lily, nope_it's_Lily on Twitter, or Lynn Alden, who's Lynn Alden Contact, at Lynn Alden Contact on Twitter. I feel like one of them tweeted or retweeted this within the last 2 weeks about what happens to crypto in the run-up to the halving, or halvening, however you pronounce it, right? Mm-hmm. And then what happens in the 1 month, 3 months, 6 months after. And it's really mixed. There's no consistent theme. There's usually a run-up going into it. And then afterwards, depending upon the halving that you look at, it's like a little bit of a drawdown. I don't think there was any halving where in the immediate 1 or 3 month window that the pullback was greater than 10%. Whereas the run-ups into the halving were double digits or triple digits. So if you see a little bit of weakness around here, Bitcoin is a market that's prone to buy the rumor, sell the news. Time and again, we've seen this. I mean, even with the ETF launch, what happened? We went up and then we crashed down for a few weeks and then we started to rally again. So initially it was buy the rumor, sell the news. I don't think you can discount that either right now, but does it change any long-term perspective on the charts or for its place in its increasing place in the global economy? No. And the studies show, I mean, I know, Vic, you and I are friendly with some of these people, particularly the person who was talking about this on Twitter recently that caused a kerfuffle perhaps between two competing brokerages and their research on-air offerings. having been a frequent guest on that network and having friendly relations with the instigator or respondent, depending upon whose perspective you're looking at. but you think about the studies here. You can back test this information. This is the benefit. If I could go with perfect hindsight and say at the beginning of X calendar year, what would have been the optimal portfolio weighting? If I'm able to be long, short stocks, long, short bonds, long, short a basket of precious metals, long, short a basket of energy, long, short a basket of crypto, right? Like what would be the optimal asset allocation so I can maximize return with the least amount of risk to basically get the best Sharpe ratio or Sortino ratio? And the studies have shown that having an allocation around 3-4% of your portfolio in crypto is what's most optimal. Actually not having crypto in your portfolio over the past decade would have been detrimental, not just in terms of returns, but in terms of overall asset correlation. The idea there is if you can bring down your portfolio correlation while sustaining or increasing your expected returns, that's a very good thing. And Bitcoin did that. So should you have some and hold it? Yes. We're talking about portfolio allocation. In terms of timing a trade today on April 23rd still? No, I have no idea. I think this is just a no man's land, as it were.
I don't believe this, but just playing devil's advocate, there would be somebody would say, what? You all right?
Playing devil's advocate, we're an hour in, you got to do it.
All right. Playing devil's advocate, you could say owning tulips during a certain period of time would have been a necessary allocation in one's portfolio. So the return of an asset doesn't necessarily mean that it's a long-term viable asset. I'm not saying I believe that. I'm just saying that would be the counter argument. We don't have enough time to unpack that. The last question I'll ask you before we get out of here is gold, which has had a disgusting couple of sessions. Do you have it? I told you before, I'm short gold in terms of GC, but it's against long miners. Okay. And I did this long short thing a long time ago, this study of price action. And so what is your max draw up in gold? What's your max draw down? It's usually it's 2.5. So your max, your best day in gold generally is going to be a 2% up day. Your worst day in gold generally is going to be a 5% down day. You effectively saw that. You got anything on in gold?
I've been waiting diligently for gold prices to finally come back in. Same thing for silver.
You want to get long?
I already got long. I think that if you look at the charts on a weekly or monthly basis, no, monthly basis for the sake of doing this, because it includes silver, because you can't look at the time frame that you need to on a weekly basis on the charting platform. So go to a monthly chart for like continuous gold or continuous silver contract. Gold prices have been trading in a sideways range for the past 2 years that has an upside target of 2575. We haven't reached it yet. Silver prices are just breaking out of a multi-decade, because it's been more than 10 years, triangle that has a high point going back to the 2011 high, just short of $50 an ounce. Silver prices also over the past 2 years have been trading into what I view as an inverse head and shoulders pattern as it's breaking out of this longer term triangle, breaking the trend line from, I believe, the September 2011 and June 2020. Two highs, I can stand corrected, of course. June 2021 highs, excuse me. The point being is that these are markets that are breaking out of multi-month, multi-year, multi-decade consolidations into the upside. So I have one particular bias when I see a chart like that. I want to buy dips. I don't want to be shorted ever, particularly not an asset that's positively correlated with volatility. So I've done this successfully once and I flubbed the trade the second time. But in early February, I got long silver. And I wrote it up and I took some profit in March. And then in the middle of the month, I said to myself, when it gets back to its 1 month moving average, that's where I'll get back in long. And on March 27th, I wrote that note for the Tasty Life Traders blog. If you know, this is a great place to get back in long call spreads, and you can hold them as long as this week's low holds. And that was the low for the rest of the month, but I didn't get long. I kind of waited. And then I said, I'm not going to chase. So I've been staying on the sidelines, trying not to chase this market and resist my best temptations. Even threatening to Costanza myself that when I finally decided to get long, I would actually get short. But then we got the pullback today to the 1 month moving average, something I've been waiting patiently for while I haven't been chasing. And so when we hit it today in silver, I did the only reasonable thing possible, because I'm not going to overthink a market. I'm just going to stick to my game plan. My game plan was buy back in at the 1 month EMA. And so I did. And so now I'm back in long silver.
There's some part of me that would rather be at these levels, would rather be long silver than gold, even though I know in my mind silver is the higher beta. So if they move in tandem, you're going to get murdered more in silver. But because that gold ratio, could you could potentially see more pressure in gold and more industrial use in silver. So if you still get a bid in need for metals, but just the monetary aspect, a geopolitical aspect in gold comes in, to the defense of your position, not that you need one, I'd probably rather be long silver, though I'm not. I am still short gold, again, against long miners. I just want to be clear, because having two positions on, I don't like to straddle both worlds and then call the one, whatever one I get right, like tell everybody, hey, I'm a smart trader. That's not what's going on. I'm hedging the long miner position. But I'm holding that gold short, and I think I want to hold it until 2200. If that happens, if it doesn't happen, that's okay. But I just think we're probably a little bit too extended in gold, and I'd rather hold this gold short on until we get closer to 2200. My friend, if people want more from you, you're a stud as always. I'm looking forward to these Tuesday conversations, but if people want more from you outside of Tuesday, can you tell them where they can go?
Every Monday through Friday here on Tasty Live, 1 p.m. Eastern, 12 Central, Futures Power Hour. Of course, every Monday through Thursday on Overtime, 4 p.m. Eastern, 3 Central, immediately after last call. Tuesday mornings, Let Me Explain with Tom and Tony. We talked about the 5 month up, 1 month down trend. What does that mean for markets, and what are the stock market's forward historical returns? Is that a good thing for bulls? Is this a dip you should buy? Check that out from today. Of course, always on X and Twitter at CVecchioFX.
My man, really appreciate it. Thanks everybody for listening. If you're on with us live, make sure you hit the like button on your way out of the door. Subscribe to the channel. If you're watching on demand, leave us a comment. Tell us, are you long or short the markets here? What are you doing with gold? What are you doing with Tesla on this little rally? And then it's a big earnings week. Tell us what you're doing with the binary events this week. Even if you don't have money on it, give us your longs and your shorts on the big earnings coming up for the remainder of the week. Until next time, my friends, tomorrow at 5 p.m. Central Time, I've been Victor Jones.
I've been Chris Vecchio.
And this was another episode of The Price of Truth. We'll see you here tomorrow, folks. Peace.
The content of this podcast is created, produced, and provided solely by Tasty Life, Inc. and does not represent the direct views or opinions of any of its affiliated companies. This content is for informational and educational purposes only. It is not, nor is it intended to be trading or investment advice or a recommendation that any security, futures contract, digital asset, other product, transaction, or investment strategy is suitable for any person. Trading securities, futures products, and digital assets involve risk and may result in a loss greater than the original amount invested. Tasty Live, Inc., through its content, financial programming, or otherwise, does not provide investment or financial advice or make investment recommendations. The information provided may not be appropriate for all investors and is provided without respect to individual investor financial sophistication, financial situation, investing time horizon, or risk tolerance. Tasty Live, Inc. is not a licensed financial advisor, registered investment advisor, registered broker-dealer, or registered introducing broker.